Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we get to sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and related music industry experts. If you love playing guitar, stick around. You're in the right place. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar. And today we're probably going to interview literally, you know, the most successful person that anybody listening to this has ever heard. And by success, I mean getting a lot of shit done and really accomplishing something that, you know, of the top 1% of people in the music industry, he'd probably in the top 1% of those guys to have achieved and done some of the stuff he's done. So we're really lucky to have Jim Moose Brown with us today. Jim's a keyboard player, guitarist, and songwriter. He's had a very diverse career. He's played on over 20 number one singles, and he's recorded with a wide range of artists and as a session musician, including playing on albums by Willie Nelson, Mark Chestnut, Alison Krauss, Darius Rucker, Kenny Chesney, Brad Paisley, Ricky Skaggs, Waylon Jennings, Trace Adkins, Aaron Lewis, Merle Haggard, Billy Gibbons, Craig Morgan, Joe Nichols, Josh Turner, Bob Seger and the Silver Bullet Band, Dolly Parton, Lee Bryce, and loads more. Man, like I feel like the interview's over. I don't need to say anything else.
Hey, that's thank you. Thanks a lot. It was a great time.
He was nominated for Keyboard Player of the Year by the Academy of Country Music in 2005, 2006, and 2011, and he won the award in 2016. Currently, Moose is touring and recording with Bob Seger and is a member of the Silver Bullet Band. Now, check this out. As a songwriter, Moose won the Grammy Award for Best Country Song for co-writing It's 5 o'clock Somewhere. It spent 8 non-consecutive weeks at number one on the Billboard Hot Country Songs chart in the summer of 2003, and the song also hit number 17 on the U.S. Hot 100. It sold well in excess of 1.5 million copies, and this is why both Alan Jackson and Jimmy Buffett have a Moose Brown wing in their house. In 2003, it also won the Country Music Association Award for the Vocal Event of the Year, and the song became the number three country song, not of the year, of the decade, on Billboard's Hot Country Songs chart. As a record producer, Moose has co-produced Daryl Worley's top 10 single, Sounds Like Life to Me, as well as a critically acclaimed album by Jamie Johnson, That Lonesome Song, which features the ACM and CMA Song of the Year in color. In addition to keyboards, Moose also played acoustic guitar on this album, which went platinum and was nominated at the Grammys, the ACMs, and the CMAs for Album of the Year. Moose also co-produced Jamie's certified gold double album, The Guitar Song, which was also Grammy nominated for Best Country Album. Moose has played on the movie soundtracks of Varsity Blues, Cars, Country Strong, Cars, and Cars 2. I said Cars already. Sorry. Cars and Cars 2. Moose was also inducted into the Arkansas Entertainers Hall of Fame in 2010. Dude, thank you so much for your time, man. I appreciate you coming on the show.
Man, it just hit me. I'm old.
You know what? That's like the, you know, guys our age, when I read all that, they're like, man, that's exhausting. I can't believe I've done that. So, yeah, man, this is great stuff. So, you know, you've worked with so many iconic musicians. I'm curious what your big lesson or takeaway was from working with the following people and also how the gigs came about in the first place. So we'll go through a few of them. Willie Nelson.
Buddy Cannon called me to play on a record of his probably about 8 years ago. And Willie is just a big inspiration to me because he's 84 years old and I watch his work ethic. And he's recorded probably, I'm guessing, 8 to 10 albums since in the last 8 years since I met him. And but I was just hired strictly as a session musician. We went down to Austin, spent 4 days recording with him, and then he goes in at least once a year and does an album, and so I've been playing on all his albums since then. But yeah, I was just strictly as a session player.
Don't you find, like, I have found, you mentioned work ethic, and I think that's like one of the strongest barometers of people in general. You know, a guy's got a good work, or a gal, someone's got a good work ethic, they're generally good people and trustworthy. You know,
yeah,
it usually really follows suit. You know,
yeah. I think we're real lucky. The people usually have a good work ethic because they're very passionate about what they do, and it's easy to be passionate when you're doing what you love. And so they go hand in hand. You know, it's hard to have good work ethic if you don't really enjoy what you're doing. And all these people, it's their life's calling, you know. That's the common thread.
Very true. Waylon Jennings.
You know, I never got to sit in a room with him, but I played on the last two records that he did, and it was really interesting. Robbie Turner, who was Waylon's steel player in his band, probably about 3 years before Waylon died, he went to Robbie Turner and said, "Hey, I want to go in your studio and record some things, just me and the acoustic guitar." And so he did. He put down like 12 to 15 songs. Robbie didn't even know why. Waylon never told him. Some of them were previous songs he had recorded. Some of them were brand new things. But when he was done and Waylon was walking out, he said, "One day you might want to do something with this stuff." So it was kind of a gift to Robbie.
Very cool.
Because Waylon knew he wasn't going to live forever. And so what we did is we went in and we put a band together of session players. Reggie Young, who's a, you may know, yeah, a iconic guitar player, played on everything from Drift Away by Dobie Gray to Stay Here and Drink by Merle. And Robbie got him to play guitar. I actually played some guitar and keyboards. Chad Cromwell. Robbie played bass and steel, and we added tracks to Waylon's, and it's called The Last Recordings of Waylon Jennings. So we actually did two records like that, where we just added to Waylon's stuff. So I never actually got to sit in a room with Waylon. He passed away long before I had the opportunity, but I still got to play on a couple of his records.
Man, what a great group of musicians in that room.
Yeah, it was a pretty cool thing. And I'll tell you something, man. Waylon didn't use it, because a lot of times when people lay down tracks, they record to a click track so the tempo doesn't change. Waylon didn't do that, but his tempo was easy. His tempo didn't fluctuate. He was a great guitar player.
That's amazing.
Great musician.
Billy Gibbons.
Yeah. I met him through Jamie Johnson. And Billy actually reached out to Jamie, and they were doing a ZZ Top tribute album, and he wanted to feature Jamie on one of the songs. So Billy came in the studio with us, and we cut a version of LaGrange, featuring Jamie sang it, and he used the band of Jamie's to record it, and he had so much fun. Here's the passion that we were talking about earlier shining through. Billy goes, "Man, this was so much fun." He goes, "What are you guys doing tomorrow?" And we all were kind of free. And so we went back in and recorded six more tracks that are still in the can. We haven't done anything with them. This has been a few years ago. But he just had so much fun recording with Jamie and the band that we went in and spent a whole day recording six songs the next day.
Wow. Was this down in Texas as well?
No, this was actually here in Nashville, and we did it at the at Ben Folds Studio, which was the old RCA studio, the big studio. And he had a blast. It was fun.
Talk about a work ethic. That guy is pretty amazing.
He's very amazing, a great musician. But what impressed me most about him is he is like a walking encyclopedia. He absolutely loves all kinds of music, not just rock. He knows everything about country music. He knows everything about the stuff that was recorded in the stuff that Chet Atkins cut in the 60s and 70s in that building when he came in and knew all that stuff. I played B3 on LaGrange when we recorded it. He knew everything. We were talking about B3. He knows all the integral and internal parts of a B3, stuff that I don't know.
That's pretty amazing.
Crazy, yeah.
Was it weird playing with him in the sense that, like, you know, we're the same age, and you know, I'm assuming you, like me, you grew up listening to all of ZZ Top stuff, you know, the double album and all, you know, all that cool stuff. Mm-hmm. Was it, I mean, I know you've played with loads of people, but I think it's maybe different when you've listened to the guy. Was it kind of like surreal a little bit, or you've done it so many times and not really?
It was at first. I'm kind of like a sponge, man. When I'm thrown in that situation, I soak up all the, like, I watch, and I really learned stuff from him. The thing that I took away, other than him being an encyclopedia, what I took away from that was his approach to guitar. And it was so different than what I thought it would be. He uses, you're a guitar player, right?
Yeah, yeah.
He uses really, really light strings on his guitar. Like his bottom E string is an 8 gauge, or is an 08 gauge, which is incredibly light. I don't even think I could play that and keep it in tune. He plays really, really light. He barely touches the strings. I would have thought the tone that he gets would have meant that he was playing really hard. But no, he plays really, really light. Has a very light touch.
What amps? Do you happen to remember what kind of amps he was playing through?
Yeah, that was another thing that was really strange. He had two little amps. He had a, what's the one? Brad Paisley uses one too.
Dr. Z.
Yeah, he had a Dr. Z, and he had an old, like a Blues DeVille or something, and he used both of them. And one of them was relatively clean, and the other was pretty dirty. And he angled them in a V shape, and he put one microphone in between the two of them. And if he wanted it to be a little bit dirty, he would boost the dirty amp. He was blending the tones. I'd never seen anybody do that before. It was really cool.
That is cool. So he's blending the tones. So what did he have, like a pedal or something, or how did he?
He was not using any pedals. No, he just ran direct. He had some sort of splitter, and just ran straight into the amps, and he was relying on the amp for the overdrive. But he liked the blend because, like a small blues amp will break up differently than a lot of distortion. It's a smoother, kind of grittier tone. That's pretty clean, but just a little bit of good breakup, you know. So he blended that with the really overdriven sound.
Wow, that's cool. Did he have a bunch of guitars with him, or did he just bring in a couple? Or
I think he just brought in a Les Paul. I think he just played a Les Paul, because when he came in, we were just planning on cutting the one song.
Right.
And then he was like, "Oh, we gotta continue on. And what are you guys doing tomorrow?" And we were like, "Hey, are you kidding?
Whatever, plans just got canceled.
That stuff there. He barely had anything with him, but it sounded like Billy Gibbons. You know, incredible. I don't know if he always recorded that way or not, but it was pretty impressive to me. I'd never seen anybody do that.
That's super interesting. Bob Seger and the Silver Bullet Band. What'd you get most out of Bob, and how did that gig come about?
Well, it came about, I was recommended as a session player. Since the 90s, Bob has recorded his music in Nashville. And so I didn't play on, he put out an album, first album he'd put out in 11 years back in 2006. It was called Face the Promise. And although I didn't play on that, a lot of my friends did, who were session guys. He was thinking about doing his first tour in 10 years, and he said, "I need somebody who can play guitar and keyboards." And he was asking, actually, Brent Rowan, who's a session guitar player, used to be, and he recommended me, thank goodness. And so one night my phone rings, and I say hello, and he says, "Is this Moose?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "This is Bob Seger." It's completely out of the blue.
That's a cool phone call.
and I kind of didn't believe it, and I looked down at caller ID, and it said Michigan, you know, And he just explained to me that I'd been recommended, and he was thinking about doing his first tour in 10 years. And he said, "Tell me about yourself, you know, tell me about your family, tell me about what you've been doing, where are you from?" And as fate would have it, I actually was born and raised in Detroit, in the Detroit area. And so I lived there until I was 14. And once he heard that, he was like, "Well, you got to come up here, you know." So you wouldn't know it by my accent, but I actually, because I've been down south for years, I've been in Nashville for 35 years, but I was born up there. And he's a true blue Michigander, and so that was real important to him. So, yeah, I came up and hung out, and next thing I knew, I was on tour with him. So
that's awesome. Was that in those concerts, is that the biggest crowds you've played to, or have you played to bigger?
Biggest indoor concerts, for sure, because he sells out arenas.
Yeah.
Before I started working with Bob, I literally hadn't played live in like the last 20 years. I just do sessions and write and produce and stuff. And so, it was pretty crazy. The first few shows I did with him, I could actually kind of feel my knees shaking a little bit, because it was like the roar of that crowd is amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. Was it mostly like guys our age in there, or was it even younger kids?
The crowds?
Yeah.
Probably people our age, but it's a good mix, because you have people our age, you have people even in their 60s and 70s, and then you have a combination of people bringing their grandkids or their children. And then you also have, a lot of kids coming up are really into the 70s music, and they're into vinyl. And like, I have a son, my youngest son's 24, and man, he's into vinyl, and he listens to Zeppelin and stuff of that era. So you have a pretty good mixture, you know, but probably the bulk of it was people our age in their 50s, 40s and 50s.
Do you go to shows with your kids?
Every once in a great while. I'm kind of like, I'm so involved in music that a lot of times in my spare time I don't do music stuff, you know. It's a chance to get away. But I remember I don't know, a year or two ago, I took my son to see, we went and saw Peter Frampton, and we went and saw Derek Trucks. And so, yeah, a little bit every now and then, but yeah, I kind of shy away from music when I'm in my downtime.
You know, I saw Derek, I saw both those shows, Frampton, when he did like the 35th anniversary thing. Yeah. And then, I saw Derek plays here every year at the St. Pete Blues Festival. And I've seen hundreds of, probably 100 shows. And I saw Derek close out the show with a song that they do called Down in the Flood. It's an old Bob Dylan tune. And it was like a religious experience when he played. I'd never been so impacted by anybody. What he did with that guitar, I don't even know how it was possible. I mean, it was just amazing. It was like a religious experience. I'll never forget that, walking out of that show.
He's really a stylist, man. He's like one of those guys that comes along every few years that's got something totally different to say, and he's influencing a whole generation coming up. He's really special.
Yeah, he totally is. I never forget that. I mean, I got goosebumps on my arm right now just thinking about it.
Yeah.
Dolly.
Actually, the first time I played on anything with her was actually on a Willie Nelson record, and she came in and sang a duet, and she liked the track so much she put it on her record, and I think it was a song called To the Moon and Back, and I've since played on a couple of the things, but strictly as a session player.
Did you play with Dave Fowler in any of those?
You know what? I don't know if I did on her records, but I know Dave and I have worked with him. I haven't seen him in a long time.
I asked Dave because he was like her musical director for a little while. And I said, what's the biggest lesson you learned from Dolly? And he goes, don't be late. He said, if you're 20 minutes early, you're late. He said, you do not be late for that lady. He said, she's really, that's the number one takeaway he got. He said, don't mess around.
You know what? I think that's a common thing with all artists at that level. That's what they say at Seeger. You know, when you're supposed to be in the lobby at noon, if you're there after 11:45, you're late. I mean, yeah. that's because they want to run like clockwork. You know, they want everything to be smooth. And if one person's late, that messes up the whole schedule for the rest of the day sometimes. So, yeah, it is very important. Mm. You got a lot of people involved in the same, going the same direction. So it's like herding cattle. If somebody's late, you know, it just sets everybody back.
Sure, that makes sense. Hey, let's talk about It's 5 o'clock Somewhere. First of all, congratulations. I mean, that to accomplish something like that is, you know, it's just wonderful, man. And
oh man, it's luck and timing, and not much more.
yeah, but you know, how many songs did you write before that?
A few hundred.
Yeah, so I mean,
probably 300 or 400.
But, so it's luck and timing, but it's still an accomplishment that's extremely unique, you know.
Well, I'm a firm believer that the music success that you have is luck and timing, but you have to have put in the work in order to for the luck to happen. You know, you have to be ready when the lightning strikes. Otherwise, you know, if you haven't done the work, you're not ready when it comes.
Yeah, totally. I'm not going to ask you specifics because I'm sure you've been asked a million times about it, but what was the whole experience like when the song first hit, and what was the biggest lesson that you got out of that experience?
Well, the first thing that just jumped into my head was I was uncomfortable because I'm very much a behind the scenes musician, and I enjoy that and I like that. And people looked at me differently when I walked in the room. I didn't like it. Matter of fact, on sessions, a lot of my buddies would start saying, well, what do you think, Moose? You know, when they wouldn't used to do that. And I finally had to say, guys, I'm still the same dumbass I was a few months ago. I just got to play, you know?
Yeah.
I don't like all eyes on me. It's a lot of pressure, you know. And it finally calmed down after a while. But it was a huge thing, you know. I mean, as songs go, that was a huge deal, and it was a huge year. And I'm glad it calmed down. But yeah, that was the first thing that popped in my head. It was just uncomfortable.
Interesting. Yeah, I could see that. So you really had to. That was a situation where it was almost people were. You had an assumed ego all of a sudden, or assumed positioning status that you had to like kind of deflect.
Yeah. It felt like that, you know. Yeah. I mean, some people would take that and go with it and take them to somewhere else. But man, I really enjoy being a behind the scenes guy. I get to live a very normal life. I have a family and been married 35 years. And wow, when I do sessions, it's almost like office hours, you know. A lot of times I'll do a 10 or a 10 and a 2, and then I'm home at night, and I get to sleep in my bed, and nobody knows who I am. And I really enjoy that, you know.
Yeah.
I get to be really, really creative because, you know, think about it. When I'm out working with Bob Seger, I'm playing the same part every night. So there's really not anything creative at all about what I'm doing. It's really cool, but I'm not coming up with anything new. But when you're in the studio, I'm called upon to be creative right now. And it's the biggest rush, man. That's what I love. I mean, I love it even more than songwriting or whatever. Being in the recording session, it's immediate interaction with other players. It's immediate creativity, you know, and then it's done and you go on to the next creative thing. So it's really something. I really enjoy it.
What are you doing, what are you working on now that you're most excited about?
Well, I'm kind of towards the tail end of a project that fell into my lap that I'm really excited about. It's a tribute to Muscle Shoals.
Wow.
And I don't know if you've seen the documentary, the Rick Hall documentary.
Wonderful.
That came out, I think, in like 2013 or 2014, somewhere in there. And when they were doing that documentary, I got a call from Recall's son, Rodney, and he said, man, we want to do a compilation CD of newer artists performing their take on a song that was originally cut in Muscle Shoals, and we want to know, would you produce a track on Jamie Johnson? I said, well, I don't know. I'll call him and ask him, and it'd have to be the right song, I'm sure. So I dug through about 300 songs that I could find, all that were, and one song that I stumbled on that I knew Jamie would love was a Bob Dylan song that was cut down in fame called Serve Somebody.
Yeah, oh, what a great song.
Yeah, so I sent it to Jamie, and I told him what was going on, and I said, what do you think about this song? He had never heard it, because he's a little bit younger than us, and he flipped out and loved it. So we went down to fame and cut it down there, and took a few players down there and cut it pretty stripped, you know, like you would think a Jamie Johnson project would be, very raw and stripped down. And then I asked Willie Nelson if he would sing on it, and he said, yeah. And then I asked Chris Stapleton if he would sing on it, and he said, yeah. And I asked Leanne Womack if she would sing on it, and she said, yes. So we got the four of them on this one song. And I turned it in, and they were excited about it. And then I don't know if funding ran out. I don't know what happened, but the compilation CD never happened. And so this track has just been laying around for the last 3 or 4 years. And it's pretty amazing. I mean, when you think about those four artists together, all of them so incredible with their talents and all so different. It's really a cool sound. And I got a call just a few months ago from Keith Stegall, who's a record producer, label head here in Nashville, and he had heard it, and he flipped out and said, we have to do a tribute to Muscle Shoals, and this is the centerpiece. And so he asked me to produce, and he's producing a few tracks too, separately, but he said, man, here's a budget. Go find some artists you want to record and go cut some Muscle Shoals songs. So I took Kid Rock. I did a track on Kid Rock. I did one on Tom Johnston of the Doobie Brothers and Delbert McClinton.
Great player. Wow, that's a great combo.
Yeah, I did one on Alison Krauss. Buddy Cannon and I co-produced one on her. And I did one on Vince Gill and this incredibly talented female singer that he loves, Wendy Moten.
Wow, what a cast of performers,
yeah,
man.
It's going to be a really cool record. It should come out probably in the next 6 months, but I'm just kind of finishing up that, and I'm hoping to get Seeger on one, but that's all kind of up in the air right now. He's got some issues right now. He just canceled the tour. We were in the middle of a tour, and he has some vertebrae issues that he's having to get looked at, so that's a little bit up in the air, but hopefully that will work out too. So yeah, it's pretty exciting. It's going to be a cool project.
Was when you went down there initially with Jamie Johnson, was that the first time you'd recorded down there?
No, I've actually recorded down there a bunch through the years. It's only about 120 miles south of Nashville, so I've been hired to play on records and a lot of songwriter demos down there through the years, and it's not too bad of a drive. You can leave at 7 in the morning, get there in time to do 10 o'clock start time, and then drive home at the end of the day. So And some days I'll do some projects. I've done 2 and 3 day projects down there. But yeah, through the last 20 years, I've recorded down there quite a bit. I love it down there.
Yeah, is it as a studio? Does it have something a little different, or is it just the nostalgia of history that's made there?
It's a combination of both. It's a good sounding room, and it hasn't changed much through the years. So when you go in there, you see pictures on the wall, and then you look over and you go, "Well, that was right there." I mean, it's pretty much the same. So the vibe's pretty incredible.
Yeah, that is cool.
And you know, if you haven't seen that documentary, or you're not into the history of Fame or Shoals, you might not realize all the great records that were cut down there. All the early Aretha Franklin and Wilson Pickett, and I mean, it's just a R&B history that's just undeniable. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah, another good documentary, I'm sure you saw this one too, is the Wrecking Crew about the guys up in New York and the Brill Building. That was pretty interesting too.
Mm-hmm.
You said you're originally from Detroit.
Yeah, I was born outside of Detroit and lived there till I was 14.
And then afterwards, your family came down to Nashville, or?
Well, my parents were from Arkansas, and my dad retired, sold his business up there, and so I moved from Detroit to Jonesboro, Arkansas, which is a mid-sized town in northeast Arkansas, about an hour and a half from Memphis, and pretty much culture shock, but it was really good for me. I was exposed to a lot of different things, music-wise and life-wise. It was really a good experience.
Like what kind of stuff?
Well, musically, I'd never really listened to country music at all, or gospel, like Southern gospel, that kind of stuff. Delta blues. You know, up in Detroit, I listened to a lot of pop and, you know, the mainstream pop and a lot of R&B and stuff. So it's just a different musical vibe down there. Life-wise, it's just a lot more laid back, and the way of life is a lot slower paced, and it suits me better.
Yeah. So you prefer the slower pace as opposed to the city?
Yeah, I couldn't live in a big city. Matter of fact, Nashville's getting way too big for me. I've lived here. My wife and I have moved here right after we got married. We were 20 years old when we moved here, and it used to have a real small town Southern charm about it. And now it's the fastest growing city in America, and there's cranes everywhere, and high rises going up, and the traffic's nuts. I don't care for that. I never wanted to live in a big city.
So you think you're going to move to the suburbs at some point?
Well, we actually, the last 25 years, we have lived about 25-minute drive north of Nashville. So we live we've got a few acres. And so I have a studio here. So I don't go into Nashville as much as I used to, some of it on purpose. I don't like that. The quality of life to me is not what it should be when you're just stuck in the middle of traffic all day. So,
man, we were up there about a year ago. My wife and I, and it was like being in Orlando. I couldn't take it, to be honest with you.
I have the same thoughts, you know. And I've got my own studio here, so I'm probably doing a little bit more stuff out here and turning down some sessions that I used to would take, you know, for that reason.
Sure. Yeah, I can totally understand. Especially as you get older, you just don't want to – no, you just don't want – it's like, you know, you don't want to do things that make you uncomfortable. That's just the reality of it.
Yeah. Right. Well, the quality of life, man. When you're sitting in the car 2 hours a day,
misery.
It's no good for anybody, you know.
Do you have any brothers or sisters you grew up with?
Yeah, my family's kind of weird and spread out. I have 4 brothers and 2 sisters.
Oh, wow.
And but from 2 different marriages. So I actually have – my dad was married and he had let me get this straight here. So I have 2 half-brothers and 2 brothers. And a half sister and a full sister, and we're very spread apart in age. We range from late 40s to mid 70s, and we've only all been in the same room one time in my life.
Wow!
Because we're spread all over the country, and not an incredibly close family.
Yeah,
that's
not weird, Moose. That's conventional now. No, it is. That's not weird at all. That's like, I thought you were going to say, oh, you know, someone's got a weird occupation or, you know, I don't. No, that's pretty normal for today, you know. I mean,
well, we are occupation-wise, we're all spread all over the map, too. I mean, my oldest brother, a half-brother who's in it, like 75, he's lives down in Texas, and he went to college till he was almost 40, and he has 6 degrees and 2 doctorates, and he's the white sheep of the family. And the rest of us are somewhere in between, from the other far spectrum, you know.
Was anybody like involved in music, or like what did anybody like channel your? Well, that was just your thing that you picked up on.
It was just me, and I think part of it is my gift that I was born with, and I had an uncle that I was pretty close to that was a great guitar player, kind of a Chet Atkins, Merle Travis type guitar player who taught me a lot of stuff. But I actually started playing piano on my own when I was like 3 or 4. Like I was picking out songs by ear. And by the time I was 6 or 7, I was playing stuff off the radio, you know. And so, yeah, it's just something I was born with, I guess.
So you have a great ear. It's your gift.
Yeah, I never learned to read music. I don't read music. So I played completely by ear. And, you know, you have to... Just like anybody else who has had any amount of success, you have to take that gift and work hard to, you know, pull it all together. It's not something that you can rest on. But if you want to be in the top of any field, you have to work your butt off. And I've done that, you know. But, yeah, it's definitely a gift I was born with.
Where'd you get your work ethic from? Or where do you think you got it from?
Probably my dad. He was in the construction business. He owned his own construction business, and he worked long hours and came home tired. He left before the sun came up, and a lot of times didn't come home till 8 o'clock at night. And I'm not sure that I have that work ethic, but I think mine's more driven just by I'm getting to do what I love to do. And you know, sometimes. We have a studio here, and I'll be working on a project, and I'll go out there and work, and it's like I'll look up, and it's 3 a.m, and I have to get up at 8:30. You know, I just get lost in it, and my wife has even said a few times to me, why do you go? You know, why do you go out there? Why do you put yourself through that? And it's like that's not the way I look at it. I get to do it. You know, yeah. I don't have to do it. I get to do it. You know, I'm very fortunate that I really, really love what I do.
Yeah. I think if you have that good work ethic, you're like that. It's just who you are, you know? I mean, it's not, yeah. You know, you can't shut that off. If you're involved in something and you got a goal that you want to accomplish for that time frame or whatever, you're just going to finish it, you know? It's like breathing to, you know, you got to get it done and that's it. And there's no...
Yeah. You know, yeah, I feel that way sometimes. But when I'm in the middle of something... it's really cool, man. I have a job where I still continue to learn all the time, and I push myself to learn and try different things in the studio. And I can't remember who said this, but I believe it to be true, man. If you're not doing something new, you're really not doing anything.
Yeah.
And you know, music is to some degree formulated, and that's why I put in this studio out here, so I could do some stuff that I wouldn't normally do, some projects outside of the box that may or may not ever see the light of day, but feed my soul, you know, because I go into town every day and I pretty much do what I'm expected to do. It's pretty formulated as a session player. I mean, it's still creative. You have to try to come up with something that's new, and you have to be listening, make sure you don't get in the way of the vocal, and you come up with a signature lick that's not copying something else and all that kind of stuff. You have to push yourself to be creative, but it's pretty formulated, you know, and so that's why this studio really feeds my soul out here.
It's almost like therapy for you, it sounds like, musical therapy in a way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When you first started playing and writing professionally, what was the most surprising thing about the music business itself? It doesn't necessarily have to be bad, good or bad.
You know, I don't really know. I probably haven't been that surprised about anything. I didn't start off as a songwriter, so I might have been more surprised about how all that works than anything. I never really gave much thought to writing songs growing up. I knew from the time I was like 14 that I wanted to do sessions. I wanted to play on records. My cousin in Arkansas had a recording studio, and when I was like 14, they started hiring me to play on local jingles and custom projects and that kind of stuff. And I just knew, man, if I could make a life out of doing this, I would be a happy man, because it's just what I'm made of. You know, it's just what I love to do. And so that became my goal. And I didn't get into songwriting until really about 15 years ago, 17 years ago, something like that. It all kind of fell in my lap. Nothing really surprised me much about the music business as far as getting into sessions, other than maybe how hard it was going to be to make that happen. It's a pretty small clique of people. For those of your listeners who don't know, session musicians in Nashville, there's about probably 10 or 12 guys on each instrument that interchangeably play on all the records that come out of Nashville for the most part. There's 10 or 12 drummers and bass players and keyboard players and guitar players, and we all work in different combinations to play on all the music that comes out of Nashville for the most part. And so it's a very difficult clique to get into, and it took me probably about 13 or 14 years before I was able to do it full time of just playing with artists, country artists, or playing live gigs and working with different musicians and getting my name, you know, just climbing the ladder slowly. And all the things that ring true in being successful in any other line of work, you know, being on time, like you mentioned, being courteous, being conscientious, going the extra mile, all that stuff, you know. When you build a reputation of doing that as a session player or anything else, you continue to climb the ladder, you know. And so it took about 13 or 14 years of hard work before I got to be in that group of people. And I don't take that lightly. I cherish it because I don't know that I'm still in the top. You know, my work has slowed down probably a little bit in the last few years. There's a whole great group of young kids coming up. But every now and then I get to work. I'll be the old man on the session now, you know, work with these kids coming up. So it's pretty cool. It's been a cool 20 years.
Was there like one particular like aha thing where you came home and you told your wife, "Hun, this is my break. I think I'll be, you know, getting the call all the time now"? Or what is it, just a slow burn and where you just got your wings and then you it was steady after that?
Well, it was probably more of a slow burn, and the reason being is because there's a large learning curve. You know, I wasn't ready in the beginning. I thought I was when I was young and hungry, and I thought, man, why am I not getting called for records? I can play as good as the rest of these guys. But I really couldn't. You know, you have to learn more than anything what not to play. You know, when you're this young firecracker kid coming up and you can play all these hot licks, knowing when not to play them is a tough lesson. And
and I think what you just said right there is the most valuable thing that you could have said for anybody listening that wants to get into session work. Have to learn what not to play. That's gold right there, man.
Yeah, it's, you know, playing live and playing in the studio, none of them is better or worse. It's just apples and oranges. And when you're recording with a bunch of guys, it's all about space and proper space. And we work on headphones, and so we have this stereo spectrum, and everything has to have its space and not crowd the vocal. And it's just a different headspace when you're playing live. Sometimes session players are not the greatest live players because they can tend to be a little on the boring side, you know, because it's all about space. And when you're playing live, it's all about being on the edge and being exciting. So it's not better or worse. It's just the guys who struggle in the studio are the guys who don't have a handle yet on that. And just, you know, I think when you work in the studio every day, you're under the microscope. And so you learn what sounds to avoid and what sounds work with other stuff. It's all about working within your space with the people who are around you, you know, and it takes time to learn that. It took a long time for me to learn that, you know.
That is gold that you just said, man. Everybody pays tuition in their careers, no matter what they're doing. And I was wondering if you'd be kind enough to share maybe one or two mistakes that you've made along your journey, and what were the lessons you learned from that tuition or those mistakes that you paid?
Man, I don't know. I mean, I don't know that I really made any mistakes. I mean, looking back, I might could find a few things that I wish maybe had done differently. I can't even think of anything right now because they all coincide with the journey, you know? And so, if everything went great all the time, you really wouldn't learn anything. So
ain't that the truth?
I can't really think of anything that I go, man, I wish that I'd done that differently, because it's all been part of the journey that's led me to where I am.
That's awesome. I would answer that question the same way. I don't really look at everything's just part of the, you know, it's not a mistake if it takes you somewhere else, you know.
And
if
I
feel the same
way. You learn and grow from it. You know, I can't even really think of anything offhand that was really bad. I guess maybe I've been fortunate in that, but no, man, it's like, seriously, if everything was smooth and everything you attempted went well, you wouldn't learn anything or take anything away from it. So it's the times that you struggle. You know, I guess in the beginning, I was pretty hungry. My wife and I moved over to Nashville, and she got a job working at Opryland in the offices, and then she worked for the Nashville Network booking talent for a lot of years. And she had insurance and put food on the table for 3 years where I could struggle and meet people and do all the things necessary. So I don't know that that was bad at the time. It seemed bad, but man, that's when you really learn. It's when you're hungry, and that's when you make it or break it. You know, how you approach those things, you know, with your work ethic and being on time and all the stuff we talked about, and constantly pushing yourself to learn and your craft and become the best you can. You know, that happens in the struggling times, and then you get to reap the benefits of that later. You know, so you know if that's what you're talking about, yeah, but I wouldn't change any of that because that's when I grew the most. You know, I probably don't grow now like I did back then.
You need to make more mistakes.
Yeah, probably so.
Start messing up, Moose. Hey, let's look at the other end of that question. Is there anything that you've done that was maybe out of your comfort zone at a given point in time, but it turned out to be a real good decision that you could recall?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is songwriting. Like I said, I moved to Nashville and I lived here. Let's see, we moved here in February of 83. And I didn't probably really write my first song until about 1999. So I lived here for 16 years without writing at all. And how the whole songwriting thing happened was through my session work. I was playing on a lot of songwriter demos. Back in the 90s especially, there were a lot of staff songwriters. There were probably 2,000 songwriters in Nashville that had publishing deals.
2,000?
Yeah. Now, that number has dropped dramatically through the years. But yeah, back then it was a really thriving business. I mean, songwriting and publishing was just, there was just so much money in the music business. You know, record sales were great. Everybody was making money, and so songwriters, the way that it would work is in the wintertime, I would play on a lot of records because the artists were off the road and they would go in and record albums. So I would play on a lot of albums, artist albums, in the wintertime. But throughout the year, the bulk of a session player's work would be for songwriters. And so when they would have four or five songs that they wrote that they wanted to pitch, they would put together a recording session and make these things sound just like records so they could pitch them. And so it would not be unusual for me to do average two sessions a day, 2-3 hour sessions a day, like 10 to 5, going in playing on songwriter demos, and they would pitch these things. And so a lot of songwriters, I had probably a half dozen or more, maybe 10 songwriters approach me and go, man, I love to write with a keyboard player. Would you consider writing with me so I could have these great melodies that I could put lyrics to? And that's how it started. I wasn't a lyricist at all in the beginning. They would want to steal my melodies basically and put lyrics to them. And then through just like everything else, I learned and listened and asked questions. Why did you say that line right there? What led you that direction? So I'm not the greatest lyricist in the world, but I do write lyrics now. And so in the first year of songwriting, I had a couple songs cut. And so I ended up getting a publishing deal. And I was with a company called Seagale Music, which is owned by Brad Paisley and his record producer, Frank Rogers, at the time, and Chris Dubois. The three of them owned this company, and they signed me to a publishing deal. And I ended up being there for 16 years. And writing hundreds and hundreds of songs, 5 o'clock somewhere being one of them. But yeah, that was probably the biggest surprise, is how that all works. And I just didn't have an understanding of all of, first, how to write a song and how that side of the business worked. I learned a whole lot.
That's a real good story. But let me ask you this. So when these songwriters are going in and doing all these demos that you're doing two a day, who's funding that? The publishing company?
Publishing companies, yeah. And so at that time, there were just an incredible amount of publishing companies, because you have to think, I mean, record sales now, for whatever reason, and that's probably a whole other topic, a whole other show, but record sales over the last 20 years are down about 60-65%. But back then, when the business was thriving, there was a lot of money. There was a lot more record labels. There were a lot more artists recording songs. There were a lot more publishing companies. In the year 2000, there were some 2,000 songwriters who had publishing deals who were being paid advances to write so many songs per year and turn them in, and they would split the money with the publishing company. And that number now is under 200. There's something like 170 songwriters who have staff publishing deals. So it's dropped by 80% or more. Just because of where we are as an industry. Some of it is due to illegal downloading, probably a lot of it, and some of it is due to companies like Spotify. And that basically what's happened is if you write a hit song on the radio, you're still going to make a lot of money. But mechanicals, record sales are down so much. And there was a time when you didn't have to have a single on the radio to make a good living as a songwriter, but those days are over. And I'll give you, without getting too into too many details and boring, whatever, but as a songwriter, if I have a publishing deal and I co-write a song, and I don't have any of my publishing, my publisher owns my publishing. So think of a song as a pie, and half of the pie is publishing and half of it is songwriting. So if I write a song with a co-writer, I own a fourth of that pie. Right. My songwriting share is a fourth of the pie. And if I get a George Strait cut, and he sells 1 million records. The rate has been negotiated years ago by the government that tells us what it's going to pay. And if I have a song on a George Strait album that sells 1 million copies, it's going to generate roughly $90,000 to be split by the publishers and the songwriters. So my share would be a fourth of that. So I would make like $22,000 on a platinum album. Well, back in the 1990s. There were many artists that had platinum albums. Everybody that was on the radio had platinum albums. But now, an artist like George Strait, it might take him a year to sell 500,000 albums, and he's at the top. I mean, there's nobody going platinum hardly anymore. And so what that has done is it's killed the mechanical rate for the songwriters. Nobody's really making money on album cuts anymore. And it's just really hurt our business, and that's why it's dwindled. Publishing companies have gone out of business and merged with other publishing companies, and there's just not money there to sign songwriters anymore. And what it does is it affects the whole food chain. I mean, there's fewer artists, which means there's fewer chances as a cut as a songwriter, which means there's fewer jobs for everybody from bus drivers, truck drivers, techs, guitar techs, musicians. I mean, it just affects the whole group. Sure. And it's been a tough go. I mean, I don't want to sound like cut your wrist time, but we're in a very interesting time in our business, you know?
No, and I'd be, obviously, this is a conversation that comes up quite often, especially with guys that have a couple of miles on them that have seen the change, that have lived through the whole change. It's a very common conversation, and it's got to be frustrating.
Somewhere along the way, people expected, well, because of what has happened digitally and it's so easy, somewhere along the way some people just expected music to be free, and because they could download it, in their minds it doesn't have any value, and they don't realize, first of all, the years of work that goes into and experience that goes into first writing a song, and then the expense of demoing the song and the expense of recording an album for an artist. I mean, sometimes they have a few hundred thousand dollars invested in the project, but the songwriters are the one in the end that hurt, because if an artist has a hit on the radio, they can make their money from their ticket sales at concerts and the merchandise and stuff. But the guys behind the scenes who write the songs, all that money is going away. And companies like Spotify, the rate that they pay to songwriters is so minuscule, it's impossible to make a living.
Sure.
The negotiated rate has been dwindled down so much that, you know, like a song like 5 o'clock Somewhere might get streamed 15 million times and literally would pay $200 or something.
Holy shit.
Yeah, it's pretty mind-boggling.
Wow.
It's something like a stream pays, it's something like 0.00006 cents per stream or something. It's pretty minuscule rate. And so the guys who design the software are the ones who are making all the money, charging the monthly fee and all that, and they divvy out just it's pretty incredible. And like I said, it's pretty tough times as a song. Well, first of all, songwriters are just going away. Where in Nashville, there were a couple thousand guys who were older and who had lived a life, and they had something to say, and they would hook these older writers up with the newer artists. And that's why I think the quality of songs, if you go back and listen to 25 years ago and you listen to a country song, sometimes you hear songs that make you laugh. Sometimes you hear songs that make you cry.
Yeah, there's an experience in there.
Yeah, you know, and you have to live a little before. And now, because the pie is getting smaller, record labels want more of the pie. And so they pretty much require all these artists to write all their songs. And when you're 22 years old, I mean, what do you have to say?
Yeah.
You know? How much life have you lived? What do you know about love and heartache and paying your dues? And so I think that's reflective in the quality of songs. Not that there's anything wrong with hanging out on a back road and drinking a beer and having the tailgate. I like that just like everybody else, but
sure.
I kind of miss the caliber of songs that we used to have. You know, I wish they could be interspersed with the back road tailgate song, you know, because it's so formulated now. I honestly play on hit records that I don't care to listen to now, you know, because the subject matter is all the same, and it's just not the level of creativity that was there years ago.
You know? I could totally understand that. It's not just music that people feel should be free. I think it's intellectual property in general. It's all kinds, because I have published dozens of marketing programs, and the same thing happens with that. You know, it's just everybody feels that, hey man, it's digital. What the hell?
If you can't hold it in your hand, they think it doesn't have value, and they don't realize that people have dedicated their life to what they're listening to. And man, I liken it to this. You know, I mean, if you go in and spend all this money, go in the studio, hire musicians, hire a studio, hire an engineer to mix it, and you've got thousands of dollars invested in this product that you sell for a dollar on iTunes. I mean, Hershey has to manufacture candy bars, and they have similar expenses that goes into a dollar candy bar.
Sure.
And if people went into a store and said, hey, I'm going to steal this box of candy bars, and if I like it, I may come back and buy some more, or if I don't like it, I won't. Pretty soon, Hershey's goes out of business.
Yeah.
And it's only because you can hold that candy bar in your hand that you think it has more value. But really, there's similar costs involved in making the product of music. Just because you can't see it doesn't mean it's not there. You know.
I think the lack of barrier to entry to being to putting intellectual property out there has probably a lot to do with that, because anybody could say and do anything. You know, you don't need any qualifications to set up a website, or you don't even need a website. You can get a YouTube channel for free or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
And the lack of barrier to entry has just made all kinds of intellectual property so accessible.
Which is great. You know, I'm not knocking technology. I mean, I can't think of, as a consumer, I can't think of anything that's better than say, hey, I want to listen to this song, Spotify, play me this song.
Right.
It's freaking awesome.
Uh-huh.
I just wish that it paid a fair rate. Because the technology is incredible. Man, how I wish I'd had that technology as a child, you know, and I could listen to anything I wanted to. I had to dig and find stuff that interested me, you know. It's all out there for everybody now. We're so overwhelmed. The hard part now is finding stuff that's really good, because there's so much stuff out there that's very mediocre, you know.
I agree with you.
There's a lot of stuff out there, you know.
Who are your biggest influences, keyboard-wise?
No. I would say growing up, Elton John.
Oh, yeah.
I bought, probably in the early 70s, I bought, I can't remember the album, Caribou and Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. And
great albums, man. Don't Billy Shoot Joel. Me, I'm Only the Piano Player. All
yeah. Billy Joel. I loved Billy Joel. I loved some jazz, though. I loved Oscar Peterson. I would listen to him, and it just didn't seem humanly possible what he was able to do.
Right.
So those are the first three that come to mind.
And how about musically in general?
I was probably, for the most part, in tune with radio, you know. So I listened to a lot of Motown, Seeger. Mm-hmm. I remember Night Moves album, Live Bullet. Back then I was driving around and had the 8-track in my Chevy van. And,
that's right.
James Taylor. I listened to a lot of James Taylor. So a lot of mainstream stuff.
Sure. What was your favorite Seeger song?
Man, I thought Night Moves was really cool when it came out. Against the Wind, I thought was brilliant lyrics. What impressed me about Seeger, and probably subconsciously influenced my songwriting, hopefully some, is his meter in his lyrics, his symmetry in his rhythm in his lyrics. I'm trying to think of a good example of that. The first song that comes to mind that it's an exact meter and symmetry is We've Got Tonight. I don't know if you know that song.
I sure do. Yeah.
The melody is da 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 da, and then it repeats that exactly. There's no altering of that rhythm, and so it's infectious. And I mean, that's probably typical of a lot of songwriters, but that was the first time I think I really noticed that was in Seeger.
It allows the listener to engage with the song much easier, even though they're not, you know, subconsciously because of that.
Exactly. Yeah. I think even sometimes with Seeger, he might even have said things a little bit differently to make sure that metered out exactly the same. Where when you really listen to his lyrics, it's like, man, I would have said it with an extra syllable or two naturally, but it wouldn't have been as infectious.
Yeah. What was the biggest, what song did the crowd seem to respond the biggest to?
Probably Turn the Page.
That's my favorite, yeah.
Yeah, that's probably the most anthemish, but you'd be surprised. I mean, Like a Rock draws that kind of, I mean, every song, his music has stood the test of time, and our generation, you know, when they go out to a concert, they sing. Sometimes it's hard to hear Bob. The crowd's singing louder than him.
Well, that's you know, I've talked to some guys, and they said that that part of playing live is one of the best experiences when they could see the connection that the crowd has to what they're doing.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's incredible. Because I literally don't play live at all with anybody except for Seeger. And sometimes he goes 2 and 3 years at a time without touring. And so I kind of get to where I miss it. And then when we go out, it's like, yes, it's so cool. There's been a couple times this tour where my ears were actually ringing after the concert, but it wasn't from our stage volume's not that loud. It was the crowd.
Wow.
So loud and ringing in the rafters and echoing. You know, it's like, my ears are kind of ringing after the show. It's crazy.
That is crazy. You remember the first CD record you ever purchased?
I do not. It would have been probably would have been Elton John, 45 single might have been, you know what I'm thinking? I think it might have been a song called It's Too Late.
It's Too Late, Baby, Now. That one? Yeah.
For some reason.
Oh, that was like Carole King.
Carole King.
Yeah. For people listening, a 45 is a little it's a little record
like
used to
CD
put.
Had two songs on it. It had one on the front and one on the back.
Yeah. Top, if you can, three favorite albums, or maybe you named them already with the Elton John.
You know what? I was not big into albums. I just listened to radio a lot, and friends would get together, and if they had a cool project that they had bought, we might sit and listen to that and stuff, but I didn't buy a whole lot of records growing up. I probably bought more 45s than I did albums because I'd hear songs on the radio and I'd want to buy the single, you know.
Interesting. Favorite childhood memory?
Oh, man, I had a bunch of them. I grew up in a great neighborhood. It was middle class suburbs of Detroit and houses close together, and after school, go out and play baseball every day out in the summertime, just stuff like that. You know, I had a great childhood.
That's awesome, man. If you weren't doing what you're doing now, Moose, what do you think you'd be doing instead?
Can't even begin to imagine that. I've never done anything else other than for the few months after high school, I got a job working at a rice mill, loading boxcars. I wouldn't.
Probably wouldn't want to do that.
You know what? It was a life lesson. Two guys would load a boxcar, 1,200 bags of rice that weighed 110 pounds each in about an hour. And you'd pull a conveyor belt into a boxcar, and these bags of rice would come down the conveyor belt that were filled up and sewn shut upstairs, and they'd come down these chutes and under conveyor belt. And at the end of it, it was tilted up. These bags of rice would come off, and you'd catch them over your head and stack them. And but I was making $5.40 an hour, so there was that.
Back in the day, that was good money. I hear you.
But I definitely wouldn't want to do that. So I almost lost my arm, and that's what pushed me.
Oh wow!
My sleeve got caught in one of the pulleys.
Holy smokes!
And as right when my shoulder was about to go into the mechanism, I pulled back as hard as I could, and my sleeve, the stitching ripped on my shoulder, and I saw my sleeve going round and round in that pulley.
Holy smokes!
And I told my mom about it, and she said, "If you're ever going to move to Nashville, go now. You've got no business making $5 an hour down there." And that's the thing about, man, whenever you're in a place like that where there's moving parts, you work with people all the time that lose a finger or lose a toe, and you got pulleys and you got conveyor belts that tuck under and, you know, catches your shoe or catches your shirt. And so it's dangerous work.
Yeah, but how cool is that your mom was the one who encouraged and pushed you to go? That is really wonderful support.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't have gone, at least right then. And she pleaded with me to get to Nashville. And so we did. We packed up and didn't know a soul and starved for a while. And the rest is history.
That's awesome, man. Happiest moment or time in your life so far?
Probably the birth of my children. I have two sons. My oldest one just turned 30, and my youngest one's 24, and they're both in the music business. My oldest son's a great engineer and drummer, but he's primarily engineering now, and my youngest son is a great guitar player.
That's awesome, man. Really cool. Do you get to work with them ever?
Yeah, I work with them both. Actually, in my studio here, my oldest son engineers everything I do out here pretty much. And my youngest son, I get to use him on guitar on projects. So my oldest son is Jeremy, and my youngest son is Josh. And yeah, so we work together. I had Josh in yesterday. He was overdubbing on a track for me playing guitar.
Oh, that's awesome, man. That must be really special.
Yeah, it is.
That's great, man. I'm glad you get to do that. Next question is, most important person in your life? I'm assuming you're going to say your wife.
Probably so, yeah. I mean, that's we've done life together, you know. We started dating in high school. And we were prom king and queen. And
serious? That's
right,
cool.
High school, and we're still married. We've been 35 years together. So, yeah, we pretty much do everything together.
Congratulations. That's a huge, huge accomplishment. I mean, I've been with my wife 25 years, and I know that it doesn't happen without work.
Yeah. You know? It was like 15 of the best years of my life.
<Ba-dum-bum>. what's your superpower, Moose?
What's that?
What's your superpower?
What's your greatest strength? Believe it or not, I think patience.
Really? That is very interesting. You think that is what helped you during that time period where you're sitting in the studio, you know, where it took you 13 or 14 years to get into the sort of the A-list where you're getting the calls all the time?
Yeah, I think it's on that level for sure, and I also think that it's on a daily level. You know, I just think that probably my one strength is I have the ability to have a calming effect, and I think that's when you get the most out of people, when they're not defensive, when they're not when they're comfortable, is when you get the best work. And I think I have a gift for making people comfortable around me. Not bragging. I just think that that's
naturally
to me. You know, I have patience, and I'm a people person. So I think that's my greatest strength.
If I asked Jeremy and Josh that question, would they say the same thing?
No. No.
How did I know that?
Because with all that said, I'm very hands-on and I want things done my way. Yeah. So I'm probably kind of demanding. But along with that, I try to make people feel comfortable as I'm getting from them what I want. So they probably wouldn't say that. And actually, you know, working with your sons is not the easiest thing because
I know.
you know, when you hire somebody who's not related to you and you say, hey, I need this done, they say, yes, sir.
Yeah.
When your dad tells you you need something done, that's your dad talking, you know. Right. So there's automatically this level of your dad's not cool. I got to have, there's friction there, you know, sometimes.
Or they got more of a say. They feel they have more of a say than than a third party would ever feel.
It's a different relationship.
Yeah. For sure. I totally get that. I totally get it, man. Let's see. What's your, I know the answer to this one, I'm assuming, but let me not assume. What's your biggest business win so far?
You know what? I think it would be a tie. I think it would be 5 o'clock somewhere. And I think Seeger, getting the Seeger gig. Because financially, the Seeger gig has been really incredible. But on a more personal level, it's been really a great learning experience watching Seeger and how he works. And it's reinvigorated my passion and my love of music. Because I've watched him. He's a perfectionist, and he's the most passionate person I've ever been around. And when we get ready for a tour, when we rehearse, he's incredibly hands-on. And just watching the passion of rehearsal, watching the passion of him during the show, it's reinvigorated my love of music.
That's fantastic. That being said, is there something that you now want to do or some sort of idea in the back of your head that you could talk about that he's kind of ignited or triggered to make you think of something else that you want to do?
Not really. It's just, you know, when you've been doing this as long as I have and kind of had been in the forefront for 20 years, I've had a great session career, you know, and I've kind of been exposed to it all. And it's easy to become jaded. And there's a great story about I'm not going to say who it was because I wasn't even there when it happened. It was probably halfway a joke, but there's a session musician, and the artist said to the session musician, "Hey, I'm kind of looking for this particular feel on this song. Have you ever heard the song?" And he cut him off and he said, "I've heard them all." It's easy to have that attitude when you've been successful for 20 years and where you don't continue to learn. You just say, "Hey, I'm the master here and I'm going to do it my way and this is the right way." And then you get exposed to somebody who has the passion of a child like Bob Seeger, who comes into every day with totally not that attitude. But I'm loving what I'm doing, and I've got the passion of a child. And the most important thing is to bring this to the people and have them love it as much as I love it. It's just totally changed the whole game for me, you know.
Yeah, I could see that being very invigorating.
Not a specific event. Like, it doesn't make me want to do anything in particular, just other than up my game in general, you know, and try to remember the love that I had as a child, and that's what's important. That's what made me want to get into this business and to keep that, because I'm very fortunate, you know. You have to remember to be grateful because I've worked with other musicians who lost that love and they became jaded and their phone quits ringing, you know, for one thing. So nobody wants to be around people like that. I love what I do, and I try to always remember to be grateful and have that love. And Seeger has just helped me do that.
That's great. Any hobbies outside of music?
I love to ride a Harley. I have a couple Harleys, and my wife actually bought the first one for me after the first Seeger tour back in 2007. It was our 25th wedding anniversary, and we were having our house remodeled, and the guy who was building the kitchen cabinets for us had a really nice Harley for sale, and she bought it without telling me.
Oh, that's cool.
And so we've since bought another one. So we ride quite a bit in our free time. We'll take trips and stuff.
That's nice. Favorite place you traveled?
I don't know if there was a specific place, but I just love anywhere out west in the mountains.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
'Cause it's so different than you know, Nashville. But all areas are beautiful. But I just, when I go out west, it just feels special to me for some reason.
Favorite and least favorite part of your job?
Well, the favorite part is the instantaneous creativity that is forced upon me in a session. The least favorite part is probably comping vocals.
When you say comping, what do you mean by that?
Okay, well, when I'm called upon to produce a project, like, say, for instance, this Muscle Shoals thing, where I go in and I do a track on Vince Gill. So the first thing I do is I put together a budget. There's a lot of different things that are required of a producer. So the label requires me to turn in a budget. How much can I do this project for, and where are the expenses going? And I have to itemize everything. So that's detailed stuff. That's not a lot of fun, but I have a program on my computer that makes it more easy. Then the second thing is I have to think about the song we're recording and what musicians would be right for this project, because all the musicians I work with in Nashville are the best in the world, but they all bring a little bit something different to the table. Sure. So who am I going to pick that fits this project with their style the best? And so then I put together the band, then I put together the studio where we're going to record. I decide on the engineer who would have the best, record the sounds that I need the best. So I have to look at their style. Who's going to mix the project when we're done recording it? Who's going to master it? And so when we go in, after we cut the tracks, we typically don't keep the live vocals. Sometimes you will, but most of the time you come back in later, have the singer sing it. And sometimes they'll sing it through as many as, you know, a dozen times, that you have different takes that you can pull from. Sometimes you'll go section by section where you'll have, all right, let's work on the verses right now. There's, while your voice is got that good growl, let's work on the low parts and not wear your voice out singing the high chorus part. So we'll sing the verses through a bunch of times. Then we'll work on the choruses. So then I may have, by the time it's all said and done, I've got 22 takes to pull from. And so comping vocals is when I go through line by line and I pick the best lines.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's kind of like being in a dentist chair a little bit. But it's a necessary part of the process because that's how you get the best vocal. And, you know, I usually typically work off of one take that I feel like was the best take, and I'll pull from that for the most part, and then but then there'll be weak lines that I'll have to go through and compare, and so you just have to go line by line. And I don't, a lot of producers will delegate that to somebody else, but I do everything myself. It's just a lot of work. That's my least favorite part of it.
Sure. You know, thank you for explaining that. It was really interesting. I mean, that whole process was really interesting to me.
As a producer, it's tedious work, and I don't delegate anything to anybody else. When I record vocals, I engineer them myself because I feel like you get the best vocals from somebody who's at ease. And so my job is to build a rapport with whoever I'm working with and make them feel totally comfortable. I'm not going to overwork them. I'm going to set them at ease, and so they'll relax and give me the best. And it's hard to do that sometimes when you have a third party in the room, when you have an engineer who they don't really know. They'll hold something back. You know, it's a very intimate process.
You know, I'm sure you know Jerry McPherson.
Uh-huh, very well.
I asked Jerry, he had a really interesting answer to that, the least favorite part. And he said he called it song triage. Where, you know, like in a hospital in the emergency room, they have the triage nurse they have to assign. And he said it's frustrating sometimes when someone comes in and you have to basically make chicken salad out of chicken shit.
Yeah, it's the hardest part as a session player, for sure. Because by and large, session players are the most passionate musicians that you'll meet, and they care about what they're doing and they want to make it the best it can be. And when you've got a turd that you're polishing, at the end of the day, sometimes my neck will hurt if I've played bad songs all day, because, you know, you're just uptight. You're thinking, what can I do to make this better? There's nothing I can do. This song just sucks.
Yeah.
But when you play a great song, you know, it's not work at all. Yeah. You can just play, you know? And so that's what he means, and it affects me the same way. I will be worn out if I play a handful of bad songs. At the end of the day, I'll be worn out because we care so much. We want to make everything great, yeah. And you just can't sometimes.
What's the toughest decision you've ever had to make, or the hardest thing you've ever had to do?
Well, because I wear several different hats, I'm constantly having to make decisions on my time. And I've made decisions that when I look back, I don't think they were the wrong decisions, but I'll never know. And I'll give you an example. Like, I never got to sit in a studio and record with Merle Haggard. I played on several of his records, but it was in an overdub situation where, or I tracked the record and he wasn't there and he came in and added his vocal later. About 4 years ago, we were getting ready to do a Seeger tour and we were in rehearsals and I got called to play on Willie and Merle record. They were recording together. It was going to be 4 days in the studio with them.
Oh, wow.
And but we were rehearsing for the Seeger tour, and I went to Bob and I said, "Hey, I've got these 4 days, but I could do it. I'd have to miss a couple of rehearsals." And the tour was going to start in like 2 weeks. And he goes, "Oh, I don't know, man. That's, you know, those are important rehearsals." And I'm thinking, "Yeah, I've never recorded with Merle, and consequently never got to because he died right after the project, and that was his last big project." And so was that the right decision? I don't know. I mean, I've always, you know, and at the same, that same tour, I missed an opportunity to be session leader on a Lionel Richie record.
Oh, wow.
They were going to fly me out to L.A., stay at Lionel's house, help him arrange, you know, work out production and help him arrange some of the songs. And so I was going to spend about 4 days at his house and then be the session leader on the whole record. And we were doing it conflicted with a TV taping that Bob, we were doing a Crossroads with Jason Aldean, and I would have not been able to do that. And so Bob was, you know, Bob's, you know, he's my first priority. And so I had to turn that down. Those kind of things, you know, I'm constantly having to make decisions like that. If I have a writing appointment and I get called to play on a record, then I got to choose. I could write a big song with this guy, but this is a record maybe I've never played on. Maybe Kenny Chesney, I've never played on his record. So I got, you know, those kind of choices. But you got to make them and you can't look back, you know.
For sure. Best advice you've ever been given and who gave it to you?
Probably my dad. And it was concerning music. My dad passed away a couple of years ago. He was 91. So he was in World War II. He was an older, he's from that generation. And that's easy to pull wisdom from, you know. But he, you know, talking about the music business, he said, you know, I remember being scared, you know, and he said, "Son, hey, you have the opportunity to have a life that I never had. I did a job that I didn't particularly care for in order to put food on the table. But you're really good at something, and you should go do it. You know, if you get to do what you love, then you're already rich." You know, if you never make a bunch of money, if you get to make a living doing what you love, I don't know if you can put a price on that. So do what you love. And so that's what I did. You know, I see people who are wealthy a lot who are miserable because they're not doing what they love. And even in the times when I was struggling financially, I was always happy. I don't remember ever a time where I went, "God, I'm just miserable." Yeah, I was struggling, but I was happy because I was doing what I love. So that's probably the best advice I ever got.
Wow. First of all, sorry about your dad's loss. You lost your dad. But, man, you had two really supportive parents. That's so – I mean, that's great. It seems like both your folks were like, you know, 110% behind you.
They really were.
That's wonderful. That's great, man. One last question, Moose, and you've been wonderful. Definition of happiness.
Well, I think we just hit it. Doing what you have, you know,
that's what I figured you were going
to
say.
Putting yourself in a position to be around family, to, you know, as much as you can. My kids both live close to me, and I'm a grandfather now, so I have 3-year-old twin boy grandsons, and you know, I'm very thankful that they're close by. I get to spend a lot of time with them.
Sure. Hey, is there anything you'd like to promote or anything you're working on that you want to let people know about?
Not really. I mean, I don't really have any solo projects or anything, and this Muscle Shoals thing I'm working on. Seeger's got a new record that's hopefully going to be coming out, depending on his back issue. Those two things, you know, look for, but not really. I'm behind the scenes. I dig that.
Well, man, if you have something that you want to promote or something's coming out, you come back on the show and let's promote the hell out of it.
Well, you got it, man. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you so much for everything, man. You're awesome. I really appreciate your time and being so candid, and it's been real pleasure. This has.
You bet, man. I enjoyed it myself.
Hey, everybody. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. Thanks again so much to Moose Brown for spending his time with us. And y'all go to everyonelovesguitar.com and sign up to get notified about future episodes. Be nice. Go play your guitar and have some fun. Until next time, we'll see you soon. I'm out. Peace, y'all. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.